formalism of generating functionals or generating functions, which is an algebraic formal way to deal, define, and manipulate all the correlation functions of a given quantum field theory. So remember, we started from the 5-4 theory, but after that I defined things in a very general way. I stay in the Euclidean description of the theory simply to avoid I factor, something like that, but it can be done in both formalism, in Euclidean and in real-time description of the theory. And the 5-4 theory is defined by an action, which is, for the moment, I don't rewrite it. And we have seen that we can define a generating function for the expectation value of operator in the theory, or the correlation function of the theory, simply by writing a functional integral. And instead of having the usual exponential of minus 1 over h bar times the action, I had a factor g phi, where g of x, g means it's a classical source field, so it's a function. And g phi means simply, in fact, it's a compact way to write integral over all the whole space of g of x, phi of x. So you see, you integrate over phi in the functional integral, but you keep g of x fixed. And when you expand this function in terms of g, in fact, you generate the functional integral containing all the different phi at different points. Okay, so this is a generating functional. Or the correlation functions of the quantum field theory. Okay? And we have seen that, in fact, from this function, you can define another function, which is given by 1 over h bar times the logarithm of this functional. So this is a number. So you can take its log. It's just an ordinary log. This defines another functional that I call w of g. And this w of g is, in fact, the generating functional for the connected correlation functions. Okay. So, to show the power of this of this formalism, now I will do an explicit calculation of another generating functional, which will turn out to be the generating functional for all the irreducible diagram of the theory. But let me define it first in an abstract way. So I define the definition. I will define an object which is called the effective action. Action for the theory. So this is a classical action. Of the theory. And I will define an effective action which is associated to the quantum theory. Okay, and let me define it first, just give the definition, the mathematical definition. See? In general, we are interested in the expectation value of fields, so in particular, we may be interested in the expectation value of one field operator at a point x in this theory. And let us assume that we want to compute this expectation value of the field phi in the theory where g is different from zero. So we consider the theory, but the theory, the phi 4 theory, is coupled to an external field, which is classical. You see? So then this is a function of g. So let me write this as a function. Here g, the field g is different from zero. It depends on x, but it's different from zero. Okay. So of course, this is simply given by the ratio of this with a phi and the ratio of this integral with no phi. So it's quite easy to see that this can be defined simply as the functional derivative of the generating functional for the connected correlation functions when you make a variation of the value of the source field at the point x. Okay? And you can check that this is true simply by taking, remember, W is 1 over h bar the log of z of g, so this is in fact 1 over h bar times the functional derivative of z of g with respect to a variation of the source term at the point x divided by 1 over z of g. And this first term is this functional integral with a phi of x inserted times the h bar, which cancels this one. And the denominator is just the functional integral. So this is indeed the expectation value of the field operator phi at point x in the theory where the external field g is different from zero. You see? Okay. So this is an expectation value of a quantum operator or a random variable in the functional integral formalism. So this is a number. This is a number which depends on the source term x and of x. So let us call this by definition phi of x. And this phi of x is a functional, there is one n of, is still a functional of the source term g. I rewrite this object, phi of x, and I call this the background field. By definition, the background field is the average, the expectation value of the field operator at a given point in the presence of a source term. So in some, this is the average, the classical, the average of the quantum field, and if there are quantum fluctuation will be occur around this background or average expectation value of the field, which is a classical average, so it's a function, so you can call this a field. Okay. So now, so you can view this background field as the response of the system to the source term or external classical field. You see? Okay. So now, what we'll be doing is that we shall be interested in what are the properties, of the quantum theory. Okay? Not when you are considering variation of the field of the source term g, of the constraint you put on the system, but as a function of the response of the system. So what are the properties of the quantum theory as a function of the response of the systems to g, namely, as a function
of
the background field 5x. See? So it's a mathematical question. And this means that I'm interested in computing the properties, the correlation function of the system, considering that instead of considering them as a function of the source term G, I will consider them as a function of the background field phi of x. So I make a change of variables. I make a change of variables. Instead of considering the quantity as a function of G, which is a collection of the value of the source term G at any point of time, I consider them as a function of phi, which is a collection of the value of the background field at any point phi of x. You see? And doing such a kind of change of variables, in fact, something I think you have already met in statistical physics. Or in thermodynamics. Okay. For instance, there is a well-known example. You have a thermodynamical system, and it is the constraint you put on your, for instance, a gas is a volume. Okay. Consider that the analog of G is the volume. And you are interested in the energy of the system. So when you change the volume, what is the response of the system? What is the change of energy of a system when you change its volume? It's the pressure of the system times the surface. But so the response is the analog of phi is the pressure. You see? Now, if instead of expressing the properties of system in terms of the volume, you express the property of your gas in terms of pressure, what you have to consider instead of the energy E, you have to consider the enthalpy H. Okay? So you have to make a change of the function you are considering in order to take into account the fact that you are considering the properties of the system in terms of the response instead of the properties of the system in terms of the external constraint you apply on the system, you see? And the relation between the energy of a system and the enthalpy is a mathematical relation, very simple, which is called the Legendre transform. So we have, in order to study this, we have to do the same thing. We have to do a Legendre transformation. So what is a Legendre transformation? Or a Legendre transform. A Legendre transform means simply that I make this change of variables. So instead of I have this functional W of G. Okay. I define from this the background field, which is the derivative of W of G when I make a variation of G at some point X. Okay? And now I consider that the function I will be studying will be a function of phi of X instead of G of X. So first I define this. Then I make the change of variables from G to phi. This is just a change of variables. Okay. And then I define the Legendre transform of W, which is, this is the Legendre transform, which I call gamma of phi. Now this will be a function of phi. And it is defined simply as the product G times phi minus W of G. So since I make a change of variables, now I consider that G is a functional of phi. You see? So I may consider that G times phi, which is defined as this integral, G is now a functional of phi. W is a function of G, but I consider that G is a functional of phi. So here now I consider that G is a functional of phi. But, and this is by definition the effective action of the theory. It is called, it's a function of gamma of phi, okay? And what are the properties of this effective action? First, you can show very easily that, in fact, this equation, phi of x equal the functional derivative of w with respect to g, becomes, in fact, there is a symmetric equation, which is that g of x is now the functional derivative of the effective action when you make a variation of the background field phi at point x. So there is a symmetry. In fact, there is a symmetry between this function and its Legendre transform. You see? It's just a simple property of the Legendre transform. Okay. And what does it mean, this relation? Let us apply it to when g is equal to 0. So let us make an application of this relation. Let me assume that g of x is equal to 0 everywhere. Okay. So then, on this side, phi of x is simply the expectation value of the field operator at point x in the theory where g is equal to 0, namely, this is the expectation value in the real vacuum of the theory of the operator phi of x. On this side, I'm just using the definition of phi of x. But on this side, this means that 0 is equal to delta of gamma of phi over delta of phi of x. This means that phi of x is an extremum, and in fact, it will be a minimum of gamma of phi. You see? So what does it mean? It means that, imagine that you have been able to compute as a function of phi the effective action, gamma of phi. It's a complicated function of phi. Okay? I'm just using a one-dimensional analog, but it's a functional. And look at its minimum here, phi minimum. You look for the minimum of the effective action, and then, by definition, phi minimum is just the expectation value of phi in the quantum theory. You see? Okay. There are other relations which relates the derivative of the second-order derivative, the third-order derivative of the effective action to the correlation function of the quantum theory too. But I will explain that later. But this is the simple case, you see. The minima of the potential of the effective action correspond to the expectation value of the quantum theory without source term, so the quantity we are interested in. You see? Okay. So now, what I'm going to do, this is a very formal definition, so of course we have not learned much as long as we cannot compute them. So I will compute the effective action gamma of phi at order h bar, which means, remember, in a quantum theory, the perturbative expansion in terms of Feynman diagramma is an expansion in power of h bar, where you have h bar to the power of the number of loops of the diagram. So if I am computing this at order h bar, I will be considering one loop diagram. So let me compute this gamma of phi by
functional. Integral methods. Okay, so at the moment you will see, I will be able to do the calculation without specifying much what is the action. So the calculation I'm going to do is not specific to the 5-4 theory. You can repeat it for any theory at least which involves a scalar field. After that, you have to dress if the field has spinor indices, symmetry indices. If it's a gauge field, the calculation is a bit more complicated. But the idea is the same. Okay, so h bar means that if h bar is small, I can use the saddle point approximation. So let me first compute z of g. So remember, z of g is d of phi exponential minus 1 over h bar, s of phi minus g times phi. Okay? If h bar is small, I may use the saddle point approximation. So first, I have to do at what is the minima of this formula. What is the saddle point? The saddle point is phi c, which obey to the equation. I take the variation of the action with respect to phi at a point x. This is the variation of the action. What is the variation of this term? Remember, the source term is fixed, so this is simply minus g of x. And this has to be equal to zero. So this defines, this is the equation of motion, which defines the value of phi at any point x, the classical field. So the saddle point approximation means that I have a phi c. Okay. And this phi c, of course, depends on g. So the classical saddle point is a functional of the source term. Okay? Now, so this is the point which dominates in the equation, and therefore I can rewrite in the functional integral phi as phi c plus some fluctuation. I make just a change of variables. So this represents the dominant contribution, and this represents the fluctuation. Okay. And since there is a 1 over h bar here, it's easy to see that the fluctuation are of order square root of h bar. So in fact, I will put an h bar minus 1/2, power 1/2 here, so that the fluctuation are taken of order 1. Okay, so this term is of order 1. This term is of order 1, but this term is of order h bar to the power 1/2. So the fluctuation are small. Okay? And then I expand. I expand the action to second order. Expand to second order the term in the action, which is S of phi. So then S of phi will be S of phi c plus, and I write this in a sketchy way. This is S of phi c minus g phi c. So this is the contribution of the saddle point. Then I have a term which is proportional to h bar 1/2 phi theta times s prime of phi c minus g. This is the second term. And then there is a term which is h bar 1/2 phi tilde, the second derivative of the action at phi c times phi tilde. And then you have subdominant term of order. Okay, so I'm expanding to in phi tilde in the fluctuation. Okay. So this is the contribution of the saddle point. This is zero by definition of phi c. And this is a second order term, which is quadratic in phi tilde. Yes? Pardon?
The second term of the equation on the right hand side.
Excuse me.
The second term of the equation.
Excuse me, I don't.
Yeah, I don't know how did you get this minus j phi c.
That's because it is a term. I am just expanding this term in the action. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to write it. Yeah, you are right. S of phi minus g phi. Very sorry here. Yeah, I'm expanding this term. Therefore, I get that. Okay. So what does this mean? This is a compact notation, which means just compact notation to mean the integral over dx dy of phi tilde of x, phi tilde of y, times the second order derivative, functional derivative of the action S, which is a functional of phi, when I make a variation of phi at point x and the variation of phi at point y. This is just a compact notation to write this. Okay? Yes?
When you rewrite phi as phi c plus square root of h bar, I don't really see how you understand that fluctuation is of order square root of h bar. Could you explain that?
Yes, that's simply because I've defined this like that, and let us put me this in the exponential. So the exponential of s minus the exponential of minus 1 over h bar s minus g phi becomes exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi c minus g phi c. Okay, then I have a term which gives 0, and then I have a minus 1 over h bar 1 half, and this term's phi tilde, second derivative of the action at the saddle point times phi tilde plus some other terms, you see? And those two h bar cancel. So you see, you have to integrate over the phi tilde. You have an exponential of a quadratic form, which is over the one. So you expect that the dominant contribution, it's like having a Gaussian integral around phi c, you see? And the dominant contribution in terms of phi are of order the width of the Gaussian. Here, the width of the Gaussian in terms of phi tilde is of order 1, which means that the width of the Gaussian in terms of the original field is of order square root of h bar. You see?
And how do you know that the width of the Gaussian has to be like that?
Because there is a 1 over, there is a 1 over h bar here. So I start from a function s minus g phi, which is a function which is, in term of phi is a function like that. Okay, so it has a minimum at phi c. And it has here a curvature of order 1. Now, if I multiply this by 1 over h bar, the curvature, h bar being small, the curvature becomes very, very large of order 1 over h bar. And hence, the width of the region where the fluctuations are important becomes small. And it becomes precisely of order square root of h bar. You see?
I don't see why it has to be square root of h bar.
Why it has to be? Well, you can just do the calculation. Okay, consider a Gaussian integral, dx exponential minus 1 over h bar x squared, okay, divided by 2. It has a maximum 0, Okay? Now compute what is the expectation value of x squared with this Gaussian weight. Well, you know this is simply h bar. So you see, if the expectation value of x squared is of order h bar, it means that the typical x is of order square root of h bar. And you can check that by computing the expectation value of x to the power 3, and you find that it's over 4, and you find it. Okay, so really, the x of order h bar. So it's just the same argument used in a Gaussian functional integral instead of being just studying a simple Gaussian integral of one variable. Okay? Yeah, it's just the square of the uncertainty. So the uncertainty. Okay. Let's see. Okay. So now, and the next term will be of order, higher order in h bar. So I have a term which is of order 1 over h bar, a term which is of order 1, and then you have the term of order 3, 4, etc. I expect it to be subdominant if h bar is small. So if I neglect those terms, I neglect these terms, because they are of order h bar with some positive power, then I'm left with just performing in the functional integral a Gaussian integration. So I end up with z of g equal. So first I have the dominant contribution which comes from the saddle point, which is exponential of minus 1 over h bar, the action at the saddle point minus the source term times the saddle point. So this is the dominant contribution. And then I have the contribution of the integration over the phi tilde. They are given by a Gaussian integral. So this is a quadratic form of phi with an operator. Remember this object, which I called S dagger of phi. Okay. It's a function of x and y, if you want. So I can write this x a function of x and y. It is just the integral kernel of an operator that I denote s dot s second derivative of s of phi. So here s of s, the second derivative of the action, is an operator acting on function, and the value of its functional derivative at 2 points x and y is just the internal kernel of this operator. So it's an operator acting on the Hilbert space of function of x, as we have discussed yesterday. Okay, and therefore, one knows that when you perform a Gaussian integration of the exponential of a quadratic form involving an operator acting on the function, what you get is the determinant of this operator. Here the operator is the functional derivative of the action at the field, which is the saddle point, and you get the determinant of this operator at the power minus 1/2. Okay, so this is the results of the Gaussian integral. See? Okay, so now, we can take, of course, the logarithm of that to deduce what is W of G. W of G at that order is just minus, so we take the logarithm and we multiply by h bar. So we get G times phi c minus s of phi c. This is the classical term. And then we get h bar times the logarithm of this term. And the logarithm of this term, there is a minus 1/2. and we get the logarithm of the determinant. And you know that you can write the logarithm as a determinant as a trace of the logarithm of the operator. Okay, and then you have higher order term in H bar. So this is the result of the classical calculation, and this takes into account the quantum fluctuation in the Gaussian approximation. Okay, and so we have an explicit formula if we know how to compute what is the trace of the logarithm of this operator. But we have an explicit form for this operator, knowing the action of the theory. Okay, so now, once we have done that, we can compute what is the background field. The background field phi of x, remember, it is by definition the functional derivative of w of g when you make a variation of g at a point x. Okay? So, remember that in this explicit expression we had for phi, for w of g, phi c depend on g by the equation which is there. Remember, in this equation, so there are two terms, remember. First, you have the term which are the derivative of g, so you get the only term which depends explicitly of g on g is this term, so you get phi c of x. Okay, and then you get terms which takes into account the fact that phi c depends on g. So formally, you can write something as a partial derivative. This term will be simply, you take into account how phi c depend on g at point x, okay, and you take into account the functional derivative of w of g of w with respect to phi c. And in fact, you have to take phi c depends non-locally, so you have to write something like that. You consider that this expression, you consider that it is an expression both of g and of phi c, and then you have to take into account the fact that phi c depends on g on x through the saddle point equation, which is that phi c is defined with phi c, defined by the equation delta of s of phi divided by a variation of phi at point y minus g point y equals zero. This equation defines phi c. Okay? So now, yes? Yes. Yes. So here I am considering a w, if you want a w tilde, which is a function of g and phi. Okay. So I'm at, in this expression, I'm considering that this expression where
no, what I'm saying is, I mean, you differentiate phi of c.
Yes.
But you have a j. You have j phi c.
Yeah, so because phi c is a function of g.
Yes, no, I understand that. What I'm saying is, you have j phi c, and the first term is from differentiating j, and you just have phi c. And the other one is j times phi c, and you differentiate the phi c. So then there'd be a j in front of the integral.
No, I don't. Why should there be such a term? I'm not sure. No. Here you have a derivative with respect to g, so you must have a derivative with respect to g here.
And what's the coefficient?
What?
The coefficient for the second term, should that not be j?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you're using a product rule. You have J phi C.
And the first okay, yes. No, it's a function of phi. Consider that W is a function of G and of phi. This is the derivative of phi tilde with respect to phi. Yes. That's what you mean?
No.
No?
But yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure I understand the point.
And you have this.
Yes.
And you're taking the derivative with respect to J. So you have this term.
Yeah, just this. Left. Just this term.
And then
yes.
You differentiate this. But you have this J in front of integral.
It's the integral.
No, but I haven't computed this term yet. Okay, so now. You're right, but I haven't computed this term yet. So now let me compute this term.
So what is W tilde?
Oh, W tilde here, I'm just. W of G is defined as W, if you want. You can say that W of G is defined as W tilde of G of phi with phi equal phi c, where phi c is a function of G. But you may consider first this object as a function both of G and of phi. Okay? So let me compute this. Okay? First I have, and you are right, a G of Y, which comes from this term. Then I have a term which is minus delta of S divided by phi of Y, which comes from this term. And then I have a complicated term because I have to take the functional derivative with respect to the value of phi at the point Y of this big trace of a logarithm of an operator which depends in a functional way of phi. So it's something very complicated. But this is of order h bar. Okay? You see? And now this is equal to zero if phi equals phi c, because it's the definition of phi c. So you see, these big terms, in fact, is of order h bar. So you get that the background field phi of x is just phi c of x plus a term of order h bar. So you see. And that's something you expect. At leading order, at the classical order, the expectation value of the field is given by the minimum of the action of the field. Okay. And that's the important point. So the background field, phi of x, at that order, is given by the saddle point, which is a function of G, remember. Okay?
Excuse me.
Yes?
How did we obtain phi c term in this equation? Phi c plus something?
Here? But that's because W of G is a function of G and phi. So first I take the derivative of W with respect to G. You see? And this gives you phi c. You see? So if I want to be a bit more careful, I can write phi of x as the derivative of W of G with respect to G of x. And since this is W of G and phi c, where phi c is a function of if phi c equal phi c of G, I rewrite this first as a partial derivative of W tilde with respect to G of x plus the partial derivative of W tilde with respect to phi c times the derivative of phi c with respect to g. These terms is just given by this term. So this term is phi c of x. This is just the partial derivative of this functional with respect to g and not with respect to phi. You see? Okay. Okay, so I get this result. So you see the calculation is a bit complicated, but the result is obvious. Yes?
What's the reason that
when we first made this approximation, we wrote that the phi is phi classical plus some corrections, which are of order h bar square root.
Yes.
Now we found that that some other kind of corrections are of the order of h bar. And what's the reason for this difference?
That's very simple. That's because if you have a correction which is of order h bar, it means that it's a term which is of order x, for instance. It's something which is x. So it's because, of course, x, you expect this to be of order h bar to the power 1/2, but on the other hand, this is 0 by parity. You integrate a Gaussian integral, which is even, and if you compute the leading term, which is odd, you get 0. You see? So it's just a parity. It's the fact that we have expanded around the minimum and not around the point where there is a slope. So because we have chosen the minimum, in the Gaussian approximation, the integrand is odd, is even in x, and therefore the term of order h bar 1/2 vanishes. So it's just the parity. You see? Okay. Okay, so once we have that, almost done.
Can I just ask
yes?
a last question? Did you ignore the other terms in the expression for W when taking this derivative? Like, how about the derivative of S with respect to the
I'm sorry, part? Which other term?
Well, like, I see that you've differentiated the first term, J dot phi
yes.
C.
Yes.
But then you have minus S of phi C.
This term, but this term doesn't depend on G at all. So the partial derivative of these terms with respect to G is 0.
Okay.
It depends only on phi.
Okay.
You see? Okay. So once you have done that, you are almost done. Because now I can compute the Legendre transform. I can compute the Legendre transform by writing its definition. And its definition is gamma of phi equal g times phi minus w of g. So this is so this is g times phi minus w of g, and minus w of g is minus g times phi c minus the action at phi c minus 1/2 h bar trace of logarithm of this operator, which is the second derivative of the action at phi c. Okay? Plus term of order h bar squared. Okay? So I can rewrite this as g times phi minus phi c plus s of phi c plus 1/2 h bar trace of the logarithm of s dot of phi c. Okay? You see? But now, you can rewrite this term as the classical action for the value of the background field plus term which are of order h bar square and not of order h bar. Here you have terms of order h bar square. And this, you can rewrite it as 1/2 h bar trace of logarithm of the second derivative of the action at the background field. So you see, here I can replace phi c by the background field, and here I can remove this and replace phi c here by the action of the at the balancing. Why? Simply because of this result. Ah, there's always this stupid things. Why? Because let me try to compute S of phi using the fact that phi equal phi c plus a term of order h bar, which I called delta phi, with delta phi is of order h bar. Then I can make a Taylor expansion of that. I can write S of phi as S of phi c plus phi minus phi c times the derivative, the first derivative of the action at term phi c plus 1/2 of phi minus phi c times the second derivative of the action at phi c times phi minus phi c plus etc. You see? So this is obviously this equation is S of phi c plus delta phi times plus this terms phi minus phi c times S prime of phi c plus 1/2 of delta phi times the second derivative of the action of phi c times delta phi. Okay? But since the difference between phi and phi c is of order h bar, this is a term of order h bar squared. Yes? Because it's not a variation, it's a difference. And I showed just before that phi c is equal to phi, the background field, is equal to the phi c, the saddle point, plus something which is over the edge bar. So I'm using this. This is not a variation, this is a difference. Difference between two classical fields that I've computed. Okay? It's not something fluctuating. And I've proven that it's over the edge bar. So this is of order h bar squared. And now you can use the equation which defines phi c. Remember that the equation which defines phi c is that S prime of phi c equal g. It's just a compact notation to write this equation. G at point y is equal to the derivative of the action at the point y. So this term is just S of phi c plus phi minus phi c times g. Okay? Plus term of order h bar squared. And therefore, this is exactly the term which is there. You see? So I have proven that S of phi is equal to F of phi c plus phi minus phi c times the source term g, which is there. So I can replace those two terms by the action at the value of the field, which is equal to the background field, plus term of order h bar. So that's the first point. And now I can do the same thing than that. Since the difference between phi and phi c is of order h bar, if I replace phi c by phi in this expression, I get something, the difference is of order h bar, and since I have an h bar in front, the difference is also of order h bar squared. You see? So the final result is something very simple. final result. The effective action, which is a functional of the background field phi c, is equal to the classical action of the theory when you take the field to be the background field. And then you have a term of order h bar, which is the first quantum correction, which is simply the trace of the logarithm of an operator, which is the second derivative of the action taken at the value of the field, which is the background field. You see? And then you have correction of order h squared. And that's a very simple, beautiful result. So this is a classical contribution of the classical. And this is the first quantum correction. You see? And it's a result which is valid for any S of phi with phi a scalar field and the bosonic describing bosonic particles. And then you can complicate by considering that this is a scalar field which has spin indices or which are symmetry indices. It will be the same. Yes?
It's probably not a very important question, but on the bottom board on the left,
yes,
so there we calculated the Gaussian integral.
Yes,
it seems like we neglected the infinite power of 2 pi over 2 or something like that. Because if you do that,
you mean that in the exact formula you have powers of 2 pi in the denominator, but you can integrate them in the measure in the d phi, you see. Or if you prefer, if instead of computing the trace of the logarithm of the operator S, second derivative of S, you have a 2 pi here, since you have a log, you have this plus a log of 2 pi, you take the trace of 2 pi times the identity operator, so it just gives a shift of the vacuum energy. It just gives a constant. So it's a shift by a constant of the energy of the vacuum of the theory, and all the physical quantity will not depend on that. So I have, for that reason, I have neglected those factors. So the 2 pi factor, the 2 pi factors, etc., can be either absorbed in the measure d phi, or there are just a shift in the vacuum energy of the theory. You see? And at that point, we do not need to consider that. Okay. So this is a very general formula. And now let us go back to the 5-4 theory and what it means. I go back. Because it's a beautiful compact formula, but it's very abstract. So what does this mean? So back to 5-4-3.
The question?
Yes?
The final result, didn't we receive that on the uppermost board? And then why did we do that calculation between
this
the,
one?
Yes.
Yes?
Didn't we get that on the upper board there? And why did we do that calculation in between? What was the meaning of that?
Pardon?
The calculation we did, yes, the other time
itself.
There
was
a suggestive
this one? Above?
Yes.
I am not sure I understand the question.
This is.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so let me go back to 5-4. The action for the 5-4 theory we have seen is integral over space, and you can rewrite this as 1/2 of phi of x minus the Laplace operator plus n squared times phi of x with respect to x, plus, and then you have this combinatorial factor g over 4 phi 4 of x. This is a classical the action in the Euclidean regime. Okay? So let us compute what is the second derivative operator. The second derivative of the operator means that I take a derivative with respect to phi at a point x and I take a derivative of phi at a point y. So this is in fact, so for these terms, which is a quadratic form in phi, it means that the operator, this is an operator. Remember, this is just the operator here, which is acting on the phi to the right and which is sandwiched by a phi to the left. So this is simply the operator minus the Laplace operator plus m squared. And we have encountered this operator already in the free theory. Remember, this was the operator whose inverse is the propagator. Now, what is the derivative of this operator? The derivative of this operator is non-zero only if x equals y. So there is a, it's an operator which is proportional to the identity operator, the operator whose kernel is a delta function. And so we, you just have to take the second derivative of phi 4 with respect to phi. So the second derivative of phi 4 with respect to phi, you know it, it's 12 times phi cubed, phi squared. So I get simply g over 2 times phi squared. So here is the operator, the second derivative of that. It's an operator. It means that if you apply an operator to this operator to phi, to some function psi, and you want to compute its value at a point x, you have simply to take the Laplace operator plus m squared applied to the function psi of x, and here you multiply the function psi of x by the function phi squared at point x. So this is phi squared of x times psi of x. Okay, so this operator means that it forms this transformation. Yes?
Yeah, in the second line of this blackboard, yeah.
Yes?
The second term on the right hand side should vanish if x is not equal y. So why don't we have a delta function?
Because here I have written explicitly phi squared of x. Remember, by definition, the functional derivative of a field x with respect to a point y is delta of x minus y.
But here we're taking the second derivative, so we have derivative two times with respect to two phis with different arguments. So
yes.
Differentiating with respect to, for example,
five, here?
Five,
yeah. Here? Well, you can use this formula. Remember, you can use this formula, which is the basic formula of functional derivative, and compute delta phi, delta of integral of phi 4 with respect to phi of x, phi of y. Okay? This is delta squared of integral dz of phi 4 of z divided by delta of phi of x, delta of phi of y. Do things carefully. First, the first derivative, I take the derivative with respect to y. Okay? This is integral dz of delta of phi 4 of z with respect to phi at point y. So you apply the usual rules of derivative. I say this is dz times 4 times phi 4 of phi cube of z times the derivative of phi at point z times phi at point y, which is delta of x minus y. So I get 4 phi cube at point y because I have a delta function and I integrate over z. Okay? So then I take the derivative with respect to phi of x of 4 times phi cube at point y, and I apply the rules of derivative. This is 4 times 3 times phi squared of y times the functional derivative of y with respect to x, which is delta of x minus y.
Yeah.
You
so
see?
What is the delta?
So now, when I apply this operator to a function psi, I get an integral over dy of delta of x minus y phi squared of y times, but phi squared of x times psi of y, and I get phi squared of x times psi of x. Hence, this term. You see how it works? Okay. So, now we have to compute the trace of the logarithm of this operator, which is minus the Laplacian plus m squared plus g over 2 times phi squared. Okay? And what does mean this operator? First, I can, since I know a lot of things about this operator, which is basically the operator which generates the propagator of the free field theory. So I can write this as a trace of the logarithm of minus the Laplacian operator plus m squared times 1 minus a plus g over 2 times the inverse of this operator. So times the operator pi squared. Okay? Trace of a logarithm of a product of two operators. Now, I know that, remember, this is a trace of the log, which means that it is the logarithm of a determinant. And you know that the determinant of a product of two operators, or two matrices, is the product of the determinant. So I can write this as the logarithm of the of this determinant times the determinant of this object. Therefore, I can write this as the trace of the logarithm of this determinant plus the trace of the logarithm of this operator, 1 plus g over 2 times minus Laplacian plus m squared to the power minus 1 times phi squared. Okay? I have just used here the fact that the determinant of AB is equal to the determinant of A times the determinant of B, generalizing to infinite dimensional operator. But that's you need it for. Okay, so once you have done that, we are almost done because we can go back to perturbation theory. Up to now, we did a semi-classical calculation to first order of h bar. Oops. Is it? Okay. Yes, there was a question? No. Okay, so now let us use this formula and try to compute what is the trace of the logarithm of this operator, which is 1 plus minus the Laplace operator plus m squared to the power minus 1 times the operator phi squared. And there is a factor g over 2. Okay. So I have to compute this object. Now I can expand in powers of g. I go back to perturbation theory. Because I know what is, you know that the logarithm of 1 plus x is equal to x minus x squared over 2 plus x cubed over 3, etc. Okay, so it's valid for operator. So I can write this object as sum from k equal 1 to infinity of minus 1 to the power k plus 1 divided by k, g over 2 to the power k, times the trace of the product of this operator to the power k minus Laplacian plus m squared to the power minus minus 1 times phi squared times minus Laplacian plus m squared minus 1 times phi squared times etc. up to minus Laplacian plus m squared minus 1 times phi squared. I take the trace and I have a product of k times the original operator here. You see? Okay, so now let us consider what is this object, the term of order k. What is the term of order k? This is an operator. This is an operator. Let us think about what are their integral kernel. What is the integral kernel of minus Laplacian plus m squared to the power of minus 1?
Plus 1.
Yes?
The power of minus 1, should that be just k? The first factor, the power, is that k plus 1 or k?
It's k plus 1 because you start at k equal 1 with plus 1 factor. Okay. It's just a Taylor expansion. So the kernel of this operator is just the standard propagator we have studied. Remember, it's just the Fourier transform. X minus y times 1 over k squared plus n squared. The kernel of the operator phi squared is just phi squared of x times delta of x minus y. The delta function in d dimension times phi squared of x. You see? So you can rewrite. And what is the trace? Trace means simply that you integrate over some point x of, take x times your operator times x. See. So what is the integral kernel of this operator? What is the integral kernel of minus Laplacian plus m squared minus 1 times phi squared to the power k? It is the product of the internal kernel of, first, minus Laplacian plus m squared minus 1, so it is a g naught of, let us call it x1 minus y1. Then it is a phi squared of y1 times the delta of y1 minus x2, if you want. Then it is a g naught of x2 minus y2, then it is the phi squared of y2, then there is a delta function of y2 minus x3, etc., up to a phi squared of yn, a g naught of xn minus yn. This is the integral kernel of this object. And if you take that, and of course you integrate over all the intermediate points, dy1 up to d xn. Okay, so the integral kernel between the x1 and yn. Okay, and when you take the trace of this operator, minus Laplacian plus m squared to the power minus 1 times phi squared to the power k, you simply have to integrate over x1 and yn with the constraint that x1 equal y1. So you end up with, you can, here you have a delta function for each y and x, so you can write this simply as an integral over dx1 up to dxn, of g naught of x1 minus x2, phi squared of x2, g naught of x2 minus x3 times phi squared of x3, etc., up to phi squared of x1. At the end, you end up with x1. Okay? So this is the trace of this operator is given by this integral. You integrate, you have a product of propagators. At the end of each propagator, you have a phi squared of x2. And you integrate over all the position of the points. So this is now an integral which gives you a number which depends on phi squared, which is a trace of this operator. But remember, now you have a product of propagators that you integrate out. So you can write a Feynman diagram associated to that. And let us write the Feynman diagram associated to that because it's a very simple Feynman diagram. It is.
Just a notational point, François.
Yes.
All these phis you've written on these boards are should be like it's the
oh yes. Then we have to take them for we have to take them to be the phi to be the var phi of the var phi of the which is the background phi. Yeah, I should have written the var phi here. And anyway, so what is this? Draw this object in terms of Feynman diagram. What is the trace of the logarithm of minus Laplacian operator plus n squared minus 1 times? OK, let me write a real var phi here. OK. First, I have a propagator which goes from a point x1 to a point x2. This is x1. This is a point 1. This is a point 2. Then I have a propagator which goes from point 2 to point 3. Then I have a propagator which goes to point 3 to point 4. I continue, etc. And here I have a term k, and then I'm closing my operator. So I get a polygon of operator, you see. I get a polygon. You see?
So that's the trace of log of this to the power k?
Yes, it's to the power k, I'm sorry. Yes. So I have a k sided polygon.
This is a log.
Yes?
Without log?
I'm sorry. It's not a log. Oh, I'm tired. You are tired, and I'm tired too. Okay. So this is this. I have a k sided polygon. And at each point of the polygon, I had a phi squared of x1, a phi squared of x2. And phi squared of x3, etc. So I have a k-sided polygons with two phi of x attached to each vertex. You see? So I can represent in terms of Feynman diagram this just as a k-sided polygon like that. And at each point, at each vertex, I have a phi, a background field attached, like that. Okay. And now to each diagram like that, I integrate over the position of the vertices. And I have a factor, g over 2 to the power k, minus 1 k plus 1 times k attached. And remember, this is a contribution of this to the effective action. So there is an h bar over 2 in addition. You see? And what you recover, in fact, are just when you take the trace of the logarithm, on this object, you will cover the sum over the irreducible one loop diagrams. One loop, there is only one loop. So there is a factor h bar. They are irreducible, but because they are polygons, so if you cut one line, they become they are still connected, so they are irreducible of the phi 4 theory. And if you think a little bit more, you discover that this you have a g to the power, so you have a factor h bar because it's one loop. You have factor gk where k is the number of vertices. And you have a factor minus g to the power k. And you have a factor in addition, a factor minus, you have a factor minus 1 over 2 to the power k plus 1 times 1 over k. From this and this, which is in fact the symmetry factor of the diagram. Okay? So you see that when you compute the effective action, the leading term, the classical term, is just the action of the model. And the first quantum correction is given by the sum of all the irreducible one-particle diagrams of the theory. So by this functional integral method, you got both this diagram, which is a k equal 1, these diagrams, which is k equal 2, these diagrams, which is k equal 3, and those are diagrams I showed you yesterday, remember, on the transparencies. But you get also the next one, etc. By the same calculation with the correct symmetry factor and everything. So you don't have to do a calculation applying the Wick theorem at each order and counting what's going on. This functional calculation, which reduces to the Gaussian approximation calculation that I did that. It's a bit lengthy the first time you do it, but once you get used to that, you do all the functional derivative in a quick way, like ordinary derivative, and you get the results. So you get the sum of all diagrams, at once by this functional integral method. And you see that gamma of phi is given by the classical action, namely the three diagrams, S of phi can be written, plus h bar times the irreducible one loop diagrams, etc. And in fact, let me end up here. There is a general result, which is at the order h to the power n. Or you get all the irreducible diagrams with n loops. So in fact, the effective action is the generating functional for all the irreducible diagrams. Yes?
What happens to the factor of the phrase log minus Laplace plus m squared?
Okay, very good question. You have this factor. This factor is just a pure number. It doesn't depend on phi. You see? So this factor, the factor is in fact h bar over 2. Trace log of the minus notation plus m squared. So, some sense, this is the value of the effective action where there is no background field. when the expectation value of the field is zero. So this is the vacuum energy of the phi-4 quantum field theory. So in fact, it is this term that contains the 2 pi factor you asked for a few minutes ago. So if you change, if you add the 2 pi factor here, you are shifting this term, hence you are shifting the vacuum energy of the phi-4 theory. And it is, remember, you can since you have this representation of all these terms in terms of those closed loops diagrams, k equal 1, k equal 2, k equal 3, in fact, you can just say that this corresponds to the k equal 0 diagram. So imagine you have a one loop diagram with no vertices. So this is, you can write this as a contribution of this closed loop with no end, which represents just the vacuum energy of the phi-4 theory. So this gives the vacuum energy, and this gives the contribution when you had fields, in the energy in the background field. Yes?
Is there any non-trivial homotopy for which we know the one group effective action exactly to all orders in coupling?
In quantum mechanics, yes. In quantum field theory, I'm not sure. Perhaps in two dimension or in solvable. Basically, you need to solve exactly the theory to have that. So you need some special quantum field theory which is exactly solvable. So I presume quantum field theory corresponding to integrable systems should be done. But in many cases, you have approximations which are good. But this object is a highly non-local object, you see, because you have propagator, so it's not something you can write locally in terms of the action of the field. Yes?
In the second blackboard there, why doesn't the right-hand side depend on K?
Depend on?
K.
K? What is K?
Well, the K is the power of that.
Ah, oh, that's simply dots. Because... This goes up to phi squared of xk, then you have g naught of xk minus x1. And then you have a phi squared of x1. So in fact, I omitted the previous terms which depend on k.
So the integral should be d1, d naught to d.
When you take the trace, this is xk, I'm sorry. I was a bit sketchy. So here, you have an integral where you start from point x1. You had a phi squared, then a phi squared, then a phi squared. You end up at point xk. Then you had a propagator, and you go back to point x1, and you had a phi squared of x1.
So we don't have anything such as n there?
Pardon?
I mean, so what?
Oh, that's n? Because I missed. I'm sorry. I realized in this equation, I wrote here n instead of k. I'm very sorry. This is just a typo. I'm very sorry. This is xk here. This is xk. yk. This is yk. And at the end, I identify yk is x1. I'm very sorry. This was a...
Another question?
A mistake of mine. Yes?
On that same line, what is the integral over?
What is?
The integral over the variable.
And here, of course, it's...
Is it y1?
It goes up to xk. I'm sorry. I integrate over y1, x2, y2, up to xk. Yeah. And yk is fixed. So I have the matrix element of this operator between the starting point, which is x1, and the end point, which is yk. I'm sorry.
y1, x2, y2, and up to.
Yeah. Yes, because you see, you start from point x1, then you go to point y1. Then you start from point x2, then you go to point y2, etc. And then you end up with point xk, yk. Okay? But the phi square means that those two points are the same. So I integrate over y1 equal x2 with y2 over x3, etc. This is taken into account by the delta function here. And at the end, when I'm considering this matrix element, just x1 and yk are fixed. And then I take the trace. Take the trace means that I consider diagonal elements. So x1 is taken to be equal to yk, and I integrate over them. So I close the chain. Yes?
Was the interpretation of the symmetry factor being negative?
It's because it's not a symmetry factor. It's because there is an additional minus in the in this factor. So in fact, when I write this, the gamma function is the sum of the three diagrams minus h bar times the sum of the irreducible factor, etc., etc.
So
remember,
the signs alternate later?
Remember, that's simply because think about what's happening in the think about what is happening at tree level. At tree level, so in the classical action, you have a G phi 4 in the effective action, which is described by the Feynman rules by this vertex, the irreducible diagram, which is just a point with three legs, three phi attached. Okay. In the Feynman rules, you know that to one vertex, you attach a factor minus g. Okay. But in the action, this is g times phi 4. So it means that you must add minus 1 in front of this term.
Sorry, this
minus 1 is in fact also present in the other diagrams. It's just that. You see? So this is why there is a minus 1 to the power k plus 1. You get a minus times minus g to the power k. This factor minus 1 is already there for trivial reasons at the order of the classical theory. If you say a vertex is represent a term of interaction with a minus g factor, then at the classical level, there is a minus 1 in front of this term already because the energy term is the action is g phi 4. And this minus is in front of the rule expression of the...
In general, the signs alternate?
Pardon?
In the expansion in H, in the number of loops, the signs will alternate. So it's going to be trees minus H, one loop, plus H squared, two loop, minus H, etc.
Yeah, yes. So that's
okay.
That's a property of the theory. And that's somewhat... there is an alternate sign. And that's not a bad thing, because in quantum theory, in fact, those expansion in H-bar are divergent series. In fact, if you go further, but the series are badly behaved if you look at them once by once. So if they were not alternating, they would not be summable at all. You have series which is something like, in fact, when you are doing, you have an h bar minus h bar squared plus 2 h bar cube minus 6 h bar to the 4 plus etc. In fact, you are in general 1 over n factorial n h bar to the power n or something like that. This is the way typically semi-classical expansion behaves in a quantum theory. And so those are series which are really non- minus to the power n times factorial n. So the perturbative series are not summable series. So the only hope to find a way to sum them is that they are alternate series where in some sense you can find a summation procedure to sum them. So if you find a perturbative series in a quantum theory with no alternate sign, it's a very, very bad sign for the signal, I would say, for the consistency of the quantum theory. So it's an interesting, in fact, it's really a feature of quantum theory that the sign alternates. Okay, well, I must end anyway. I already, I think Anidhi must be quite upset. Sorry, I have many questions.